Insurance Pool Governing Board. And I would like to welcome Jan Dean and Rocky King and Mr. Britton. Over here, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanna. I'd like to start with the materials that I handed out last Friday morning. They look like this. And it's just a brief introduction. We have already had a hearing on phase one of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and we've talked about them as well privately, so you're familiar with them. Their agency mission is to encourage and assist Oregon small businesses and consumers in making informed health insurance choices by providing outreach, education, and referral services. Providing access to health insurance through a program for low-income uninsured Oregonians. This would be the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEOP, and by developing and certifying health benefit plans for uninsured small businesses. And the Insurance Pool Governing Board itself has certified, as I understand it, two plans that Rocky talked about in phase one, but he can talk a little bit more about those during the phase two hearing today. The primary programs and customers, the agency has two programs, the Information, Education, and Outreach Program and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEOP. And FEOP is the larger, much larger, of the two programs, about $80.8 million total funds, $26.4 million general fund in the governor's recommended budget. And this represents a significant increase over the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget. I've bulleted several major policy and budget issues. Probably the most important one is the requirement under the Oregon Health Plan 2 waivers that the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, it has a five-year maintenance of effort requirement. And this requirement means that the agency must spend $40.9 million of state funds, not just general fund, but it could also be, as it is, tobacco tax or tobacco settlement dollars, actually, over 5 years. And this maintenance of effort requirement began in November of 2002 when the OHP2 waiver began. And it ends 5 years later, October 31st, 2007. So we've got 4 months into the 07-09 biennium in which to complete this maintenance of effort. In February, the agency reported that it would be unable to spend $3.6 million of state funds that had been allocated to it for the current biennium. And I've noted here it's about $2 million of tobacco settlement carryover from the 2001-03 biennium. And that was a time when FEOP was funded, at least the state portion was funded, with tobacco settlement, as well as about $1.6 million of general fund. These funds must either be spent during the current biennium or carried over to the 2005-07 biennium and added to the level of general fund included in the governor's budget if the agency is to remain on course to meet its maintenance of effort requirement. And as I've noted here, the agency would need to expend about $4.6 million in state funds during the first 4 months of the 2007-09 biennium to meet the maintenance of effort requirement. So again, five-year maintenance of effort requirement. The agency is working to spend money effectively, cost effectively, and this is a maintenance of effort requirement that is about $40.9 million.
Okay, just for clarification then,
sure.
In the governor's recommended budget, the general funds allocated are $26,906,352. That is, all of that is necessary to complete, to stay on course to complete the $40.9 million maintenance effort that's required over the 5 years. And in addition to this amount, we probably will need to add the $3.6 million that will be unexpended at the end of the current biennium.
That's close, Mr. Chair. The number that you cited is for the entire agency, and some of that is not does not count toward maintenance of effort.
And which would be just the portion that goes toward
the information, education, and outreach does not count, and the staffing requirement within the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The only dollars that count, if you will, toward maintenance of effort are those expended for premium subsidies through FEOP.
I see.
And actually, that's a good segue into the second bullet point. What is an appropriate level of administrative activity and cost to implement the FEOP program? Note that administrative costs, both within the FEOP as well as in the marketing information and referral program, do not count as maintenance of effort spending. So this, in effect, gives the agency an incentive to keep its administrative costs down because they don't help us get to the maintenance of effort, at least directly. But on the other hand, you have to have some administrative costs in order to run the program. The question, as a budget question, is just how much is enough? What gets the job done effectively? The third bullet here is the ability of the agency to market FEOP to small business employers. Group insurance is a more cost-effective way than individual insurance to provide health insurance coverage through the FEOP. And I'd point, if you flip over to the LFO analysis, it's a couple of pages back, right before the maintenance of effort discussion paper. At the bottom of the page is a small chart. And if you look at the third line down where it says the average FEOP subsidy. Well, it looks like this. And it's the last page of the LFO. Keep going, I think.
Page 4 of the LFO.
The third line down shows the average FEOP subsidy. And under group plans, notice that it's about $99, $98.82. Over under the individual plans, it's about three times that, meaning that you can cover three times as many people under the group plans as you can under the individual plans for the same amount of money. As a consequence, the legislature in the past has strongly encouraged the agency to market to small employers in order to generate expenditures of FEOP for group policies as opposed to individual policies. But I've noted here that marketing to small business employers takes time, and the employers understandably want assurances that the FEOP is here to stay. These assurances are sometimes hard to provide or hard to believe given the state's budget situation. Demand for individual FEOP subsidies, on the other hand, has been and continues to be strong. So over the course of particularly the latter part of 2001-03 and the first part of this biennium, Rocky and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program had to be sure that when they spoke to an individual employer that they had money to back up what they were saying and trying to sell, in other words. Finally, I've noticed that cost drivers, rising uninsured population in Oregon, and the higher cost of medical insurance premiums. As they go up, again, for the same amount of money, you can serve fewer people. So this is a cost driver within this program. As far as budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings, there are none. However, the Secretary of State recently notified the Insurance Pool Governing Board that it would be conducting an audit of the board's cash receipts and disbursements and compliance with applicable laws and regulations. And the Secretary of State indicated in its letter that the field work would be completed by May of 2005. revenue sources. The agency is funded with general fund and receives federal Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, matching funds. These are federal dollars from the Department of Human Services, and they are spent within FEOP and the other parts of the agency as other funds. As noted above, the agency has $2 million of tobacco settlement revenue that it has carried over from the 2001-03 biennium, and the governor's recommended budget includes $125,000 of revenue that would be generated from new insurance carrier assessments when a certified plan is sold. And as I said earlier, there are two certified plans that Rocky will be talking about.
Question?
Senator Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm surprised at the tobacco settlement revenue going to insurance pool governing board. Is this standard? Is this something that, you know, I'm always looking for money to go somewhere else. Sorry, Rocky. But with these new the new fees that you would be getting even come close to $2 million that we would be getting if the small business plans, if we get a lot of small businesses buying into our plans. I'm just...
Why don't we go ahead and have Alden.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moniz Anderson, first of all, the $2 million of tobacco settlement is carryover, money that was not spent in 2001-03 when all of the state funds were tobacco settlement that went into this agency. So this was an agency that received some amount of tobacco settlement, didn't spend it in 2001-03, and it has been carried over now into 2003-05, and it may be carried over again into 2005-07. But it would be an expenditure that would contribute to the state's maintenance of effort requirement. As far as the carrier assessments, my guess, and we'll confirm this later, is that they would not go, they would not be nearly as high as $2 million. And my further guess is that 125 is optimistic at best. Does that answer?
Yes, it's just going back to the maintenance of effort agreement.
Yes.
that we have to have a certain amount, and so this was one way to get that money to meet that requirement.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moniz Anderson, yes, that's right. And the assessment is imposed through House Bill 2062. Again, the only thing I would note about the governor's recommended budget is that it provides funding to enable the agency to meet its OHP2 maintenance of effort requirement. And Jan will be talking more about the governor's budget, Jan Dean, from the Budget and Management Division in a moment. Selected legislation. There were, I think, about 17 different bills related to the Insurance Pool Governing Board, including the budget bill, Senate Bill 5516. But I only selected three of them, so I apologize if your favorite bill isn't on my list. But I have Senate Bill 303, which creates the Office of Private Health Partnerships. It transfers the functions and duties of the Insurance Pool Governing Board to the Office of Private Health Partnerships and abolishes the Insurance Pool Governing Board. House Bill 2062, again, which imposes a temporary assessment on carriers selling the certified health benefit plans to small employers. And finally, House Bill 2064, which would include dependent elderly relatives and dependent adult disabled children as part of the family for purposes of Family Health Insurance Assistance Program eligibility, clarifies certain health insurance statutes. I've attached two things, the LFO analysis of the budget, and very important, and I would really encourage you to read this, which is the maintenance of effort discussion paper. and it was developed by the governor's or by the insurance pool governing board staff and presented to the governor's health policy team, and that is attached to this as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Britton before we get into the rest of our meeting? I do need to let the committee know that we will need to adjourn today at 9:25, so it'll be a shorter meeting than normal. So with that, why don't we dive in? And by the way, one of the things that will really need to be dealt with is the reality that employers may be very wise in their concern about not diving into this program, since if it weren't for the maintenance of effort, there may not be $26 million from the current budget going into this program. And so that would be something that we'd like to have you deal with as well, because you're kind of in a catch-22 of that reality. So if you could continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jan Dean. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. I believe that John is passing out a copy of my presentation. If you turn to page 2, those charts show you the human services program area statewide by total funds on the left hand of the paper and general fund on the right, and you can see that the insurance pool governing board's budget is 1% of the general fund and just under 1% of total funds at 0.8%. Turning to page 4, you'll see that the agency's fund split there for you. It's got just under $30 million general fund dollars, or 33% of its budget, and $54.5 million of other funds, which, as John told you earlier, are federal funds that are matched through DHS and then returned to this department as other funds. Page 5 shows the budget categories, and special payments are the largest part of this budget at 89% of the budget, $72.5 million.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
Just real briefly, what are special payments again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, special payments are the dollars that go out to individuals in the insurance program, so they're the funding really for the insurance program.
Thank you.
Okay, as compared to what other kind of payments?
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
They're special payments, so I'm saying as compared to what other kind of payments?
Good point, Mr. Chair. And I know that earlier a question was asked on someone's budget. If you remove the special payments and look only at services and supplies and personal services, you'll find that the personal services are actually 65% of this budget, and services and supplies account for about 35% of the budget. Turning to page 6, you'll see the governor's recommended budget is an increase of just over 70%. This large increase in general fund is intended to meet that federal maintenance of effort requirement that John mentioned earlier. Page 7, this expansion that the 2001 legislature approved is part of a larger waiver, federal waiver related to the Oregon Health Plan, and it does allow FEOP to obtain the federal matching funds that John referred to, Medicaid and both the state children's health insurance program. And on average, this program receives approximately 65% match.
Yay! Welcome, welcome.
Well, hello there.
Hello.
We welcome back Senator Whitney. Yeah.
All right. Yay.
In order to meet its federal obligations, as John also mentioned, this maintenance of effort will require Oregon to continue its current expansion through the first several months of the 2007-2009 biennium as well. And that concludes.
Just a question then?
Senator Moniz Anderson.
Thank you. What would happen if this biennium we just couldn't, we decided let's just delay this maintenance of effort for 2 years? Is that even possible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, we have looked at various possibilities, and I Rocky probably would like to leap in here as well. Clearly, the state itself would be under sanction by the federal government. And I think from my perspective, one of the things that concerns me most is not just this program, but as I understand it, the Oregon Health Plan itself that would be potentially in trouble as well. But as I said, Rocky has more information if you'd like a further.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I mean, this is an issue that...
Please.
Pardon?
Could you identify yourself?
Excuse me. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board. Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I will tell you that we and the governor's staff have really looked at this issue extensively, and we looked at a variety of options. Could we renegotiate the terms and, in an essence, say, can we pay out less in terms of the maintenance of effort than what's required? We looked at, would it be possible to extend the period of time rather than 5 years? Could we get 7 years or 8 years? There's a variety of different options that we really looked at. The problem that we kind of run into is that within the next 18 months, we're about ready to negotiate a new five-year demonstration for OHP, Oregon Health Plan 2, or what will be Oregon Health Plan 3. And very frankly, to enter those negotiations while you're trying to lessen some of your obligations under your previous five-year agreement, it was felt would put the state of Oregon at a tremendous disadvantage. And that is not a disadvantage that we would want to be in, because the funds for OHP, or Oregon Health Plan 3, are much larger than the $23 million we would look at trying to reduce, whether that would be $10 million or $5 million or whatever. Plus, there are some other negotiations with the federal government, and I don't quite understand it, but MUPL, I'm assuming everybody in the legislature knows about that $140 million that the federal government would like to have Oregon pay back. And my understanding is negotiations are going quite well. Mr. Weeks, I think, has provided testimony at one of the committees on that, or will be. And the concern is to interfere with, again, what is a larger, much larger dollar issue, and put us at a disadvantage during that negotiation period would be something the governor would not like to do. The final one is, what if you just don't meet it? I mean, you don't negotiate it, you don't extend it, you just make a decision not to do that. The problem that you run into there is we would be, as far as we know, the first state who didn't meet its obligation of maintenance of effort, and that would put us at a disadvantage, again, down the road in our negotiations or in some of our requests that we might make. But secondly, it could put the whole program into jeopardy, the whole waiver, and the amount of federal dollars or federal funds that we could lose would, or the flexibility, for example, the prioritized list. They could deny all of that, go back to step one again, and the cost of that would be much, much bigger than any $4 or $5 million. It's not that and I think this is, we all should be frank here, it's not that the governor wants to have this program go up the way it's going up this next biennium. I think all of us have had our choice. We would much rather have a steady program, the message to employers, the message to individuals, the message between the governor and the legislature would be much clearer if we had a steady program. But we made some decisions in 201, 203 that put us into this position by taking some of the funds and with the anticipation that we would fund the program to meet maintenance of effort down the road. So I don't know if that kind of answers it. It's not anybody sitting back and jumping up and down with joy that we've put ourselves into this position, but we are where we are, and this was the governor's proposal to meet our obligations as a state as expressed in the waiver in 2002.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to try to probably oversimplify this, but I want to understand, where I think we are. We have a pool of funds available to help small employers supplement health insurance through this plan. With this funding, we really have more funding than we're able to market the program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, it's a mixture of individual and group market. It wasn't the intent that we would do the entire fiat program with group market. The objective initially established by the legislature was, I think, I want to go to when the waiver was first approved, was a 50-50 split between group and individual. So we've generally kept the individual market closed during the first part of the 201 through 203, 204, while group picked up. The problem was group didn't grow as fast as what anybody anticipated. And we knew that when we established that. And I believe Senator Winters was on the waiver application steering committee when we really debated this, as well as Senator Westland. We didn't know how fast or how far group would grow. I think it has gone slower than what we originally thought, but it continues to go up every month, just not at the level that we wanted.
Follow up. What is the percentage of individual versus group at this point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hanna, I have a handout that shows you as of the end of this month, or this last month. And when that gets there, I'll draw your attention to, and this is just a summary that we're trying to keep everybody up to date on. I draw your attention to the bar graph below, and you'll notice, first of all, I want to point out that we have about 10,200 enrollments in FIOP. Last month, we had the largest number of enrollments we have ever had in 1 month, almost 1,000, a little over 1,000 new enrollments. And once you take terminations away, about 800 net enrollments. And if you look at that, group market stood at 4308 and individual market about 5861. So it's about 60-40 right now, 60% individual and 40% the group market. Group market did come down a little last month, but we anticipate it will resume its 50 to 100 new people per month starting this month.
Yes, teacher.
Senator Winter.
Rocky, have you taken a look at some of the processes or procedures? I'm particularly talking about the application process with the group market, and any look at it in order to streamline it in a way to where it isn't as cumbersome for small businesses. One of the concerns that I consistently hear from small businesses, if you've got too much paperwork, if you've got too many groups to overcome, it just becomes something that they just will not access, even if they want to. And so have you looked at methods or way of trying to streamline that process? Last session, as you know, we had the same discussion, and we also, increased funding in order to go out and do more PR and what have you in order to actually increase the group market. And instead of increasing the group market, we still have seen that it hasn't grown. So have you looked at that, and have you come up with any plans that could help streamline that process?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, Senator Winters, you bring up a good point. Let me give you a little historical context to this. When the program was state-funded only, the policy of the legislature was that we would subsidize any eligible family in any group plan as long as that employer chose to provide that plan, irrespective of what the benefit was. If an employer was good enough for the employer and the other employees, then it was good enough for us to subsidize. When the waiver took place in 2002, we had a little switch in that the federal government required that we expend only dollars on group plans that met a federal benchmark. And that federal benchmark was actuarially equivalent to what the Medicaid package was, including our copays and deductibles, but basically the same benefits. So the first thing that the board had to do in 2002 was to establish really a benchmark benefit based on the Medicaid program per the federal requirement. That created a whole bunch of additional work for employers. Initially, all we had to do was get premium information from employers. But all of a sudden in 2002, because of that, we had to get benefit information from the employers to ensure that we were able to subsidize their benefit plan. The other thing that took place is when we first started this program, when somebody enrolled in group coverage, we would prospectively reimburse them. That is, we knew their premium was going to be $300, and if they were at a 70% premium level, we would just send them the first of every month $210, and we would wait then 30 days for them to send us back evidence through a pay stub that that's what they spent, and that would generate the check for the next month. There are some states that just, once you're eligible, just send 12 checks and don't ever worry about anything else, whether you drop out or not. But we required at least they show us they're still enrolled in the group plan. The problem we ran into with that, and that was very streamlined for everybody, the problem is when anybody terminated, they always owed us 1 month of premium. And so everybody all of a sudden went into this collection mode. Now, some folks, that was not a problem. They got better jobs and earned more money. They could pay it. But a lot of those people, especially during the bad economy we had, were losing their jobs, and thus they went into a collection mode. So we made a decision to actually make the payments prospectively. That is, after they were deducted from a person's check, we would reimburse them as soon as we received some sort of verification from that individual. Now, an employer is only involved in this process at the initial application when they provide benefit information. Once that starts, until the next year during certification, again, to provide that they have those same benefits and what the premiums are, the employer has no contact with us. So it's that initial thing that is really the difficult part. Let me just tell you that a month and a half ago, we brought on Kelly Harms, and some of you know her from years past. She used to work with us. She went to DHS. We brought her back about 2 months ago. Kelly knows our program inside and out, and her number one task is to review every policy, every procedure, and every process of both the group and individual market with the objective of streamlining, doing better customer service, and reducing administrative costs. And that customer service is both for the applicant as well as the employer, as well as for us, as well as for other stakeholders. So, Senator Winters, that's the long answer. The short answer is we're trying to tackle that. We've got some work groups that are looking at the group market to make it easier.
Follow up. Have you explored the feasibility or the possibility of treating it the same way that we do refunded tax credits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we haven't recently, but that is an issue that was discussed about 2 years ago with the Department of Revenue, and it is one that I've asked Kelly Harms again to look at all the different possibilities for reimbursing employees for the group coverage, and refundable tax credit is one of those options she's looking at.
I would be very followed. I'd be very interested in talking and pursuing that line. It's a simple way. It's a much more simple way of conducting business, and I think from an employer perspective than the current method that we currently use.
Senator Winters, that's one of the options that Kelly has been instructed to look at. To help streamline it for both the employee and the employer.
When does she plan to have her report completed? Or,
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I'm hoping that all the interviews, because she's interviewing all kinds of folks, both internally and externally, to try to get a good handle on this, but we're hoping over the next 60 to 90 days we'll have a series of procedure, policy, process, and organizational changes to help bring that administrative cost down and to ease the enrollment process for everybody.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, wouldn't, if I'm understanding the sequence of events here, wouldn't the employer always be on the hook also for the difference between when they paid the premium and when they withheld it from the employee's check?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, the employer is not responsible for any subsidies. Let me just kind of go through how it works. The premium, we'll say, is $100, just make it simple. And the employee share is 50. The employer is going to put up the other 50. Okay? When the person is paid, they're actually deducted the $50 of their share. The employer matches their $50 and sends it to the carrier. So it's taken care of. The problem is how do you then reimburse the employee for their $50? And they do that by sending us a copy of their wage stub. It's dispatched to us, and it can be done weekly, monthly, depends on the cash flow needs of that individual. And within 48 hours, or I should say, two business days, we're able to send to them the reimbursement for their share of the premium. There are some employers who want to actually participate by loaning the money, I guess you might say, and having us pay the employer. The employer pays part of the employee share, and then we reimburse the employer. But most employers, and we've had, we've dealt with hundreds of these employers, and a lot of focus groups, they don't want any extra paperwork. They really would rather step back and say, it's really between you and the employee, and other than the annual certification of our benefit package and what the premiums are, we really don't want to get involved.
I want to follow up. I guess I'm not. I must be missing something. The bill comes to the employer. It's a $100 premium. For 10 employees, it's $1,000. They write the check for $1,000 to the insurance company. They covered the $50 already, did they not? The $50 that would be your share?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, yes, except that they deduct that $50 from the employee on a monthly, weekly, whenever they pay them.
Yeah.
So they get reimbursed the employee's share right away.
Yeah. I understand, but they pay it on the 28th at the end of the month to proactively cover their employees for the next month, and the payroll doesn't happen until the 5th, so they're still in the game because they've still prepaid their premium for their policy, and they don't get their money back from the employee until the next pay period.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
Yeah.
And then the issue is not reimbursing the employer,
right.
You're reimbursing, how do you reimburse then the employee when it's taken out?
Actually, it's both. FEOP's issue is reimbursing the employee, but from the employer's standpoint, if the employee left on the 2nd of the month,
you're out the money.
The employer is out the money.
That's my point. They're at risk still.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is true whether it's a FEOP subsidy or not a FEOP subsidy. Any employee that leaves that they've paid the insurance, whether they're going to be reimbursed through a subsidy or not, the employer's on the hook.
Right. Could I direct your attention just to answer a question? I'm looking at this scale here showing monthly enrollment 2003-5 biennium. When I look at these numbers, are these the total in the program as of the end of that month?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay, then I'm now turning into the performance data summary sheet, page 17, which is behind tab 2 in the white book.
This is within the budget book binder, not the budget presentation binder. Rocky,
it's a white
different book.
Budget book.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, it shows the numbers of employee of enrolled, and it shows as of the end of 2003 the number of 11,857. And the chart that you have provided us shows that as of the end of December of, let's see.
Mr. Chair, that is the number of lives that at one time in the performance measures, I believe, that is the number of lives during the entire year at one time were enrolled. So, for example, in July of 2003, I may show 5,535 enrolled, but between July 2002 and June 2003, I may have had 11,000 people actually participate in the program at one point.
No, I understand. I just don't see the relevance of that number.
This is the number at the end of the month. The gain would be that. And he's saying if, in fact, he's looking at something else that has a different number than what we're showing here, what's the difference? You're saying it's a cumulative number.
And I apologize, Ms. Chair. I don't have that. I didn't bring my budget book with me this morning. I usually have it. But performance measures are based on the number of lives during the year that someone was enrolled.
I understand. You know, education, I think, gets funded based on the number of of children that happen to have been in school for one day or more any time within the year, not on average daily attendance. And so what I'm hearing you say is this is kind of like that, in that if they were enrolled and then they're gone, then that number is going to show up here. But this is as of the end of each of these months.
That is correct.
Which actually points out a real interesting kind of point in this program, and that is that you've got a high turnover. You know, you've got 12,000 people that were in the program at some time during 2003, but if you look at the numbers in 2003, you know, you're between 5,500 to an ending balance, or as of the end of December, under 6,000. And so you've got a huge turnover going on in this program.
Mr. Chair, if that is changing dramatically, and if I could call your attention to the, it's in the agency overview in the back of the book, and back of our budget book, I believe in the statistical package. And it shows the average length of stay has, it's on page 24 of the agency brief.
Okay, tab number?
It's in last tab, and it's the second green divider in the appendix.
Okay. Agency brief,
page 24.
Okay.
If you look at the top left hand,
enrollment,
you will see that the length of enrollment by market type, and this is beginning to get, I should say, increase as we've matured as a program. I can get you the historical data on that too, but the active FIAT members for OMIP is about 17.5, and I believe this was as of 2 months ago, as of the end of February.
17.5 what?
Months in the
average months.
Months.
17.5 months enrolled. Terminated is 14.1. Non-OMIP individual is 20.2, terminated is 15.9, and the group, the average for those people that are enrolled has been 26.6, terminated has been 14.6. As the program grows, those that move in and out has a less of an impact as people stay in the program longer. So you will see, I believe, over the next 2 years, that 6,000 to 10,000 figure come closer together.
Okay. Would you like to address the question, because of the time we're going to be, we're kind of a short meeting today, that I have on, you have indicated on multiple occasions that part of the reason in the difficulty in getting employers to buy in is their concern over what will happen in 2 years or in the future, because if funding stops, then they're left with the decision of going to their employees and saying, guess what, you had group insurance, now we're going to cut it, or I'm going to have to pick it up and pay what OMIP, I mean, what FIOP was paying, which, you know, is something that the employer might want to decide on his own rather than having it forced on him because of what goes on in Salem. And then that's it's a very real concern employers have, and then deal with the reality that because of maintenance of effort, we are doubling the size of the program, going to $26 million worth of state general funds
when in all reality we would not go that kind of money if it weren't for maintenance of effort. And so the concerns the employers have seem like it's a very real concern.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, it might be helpful to understand, and John had some charts in the, Mr. Britton had some charts in his presentation, why the average cost is so much higher in the group market than individual market. So I think it's important. In the group market, 50% of our enrollments are kids. I think that's a key piece. In the individual market, you have two distinct markets. You have one which is the normal 35 or 25-year-old person, and that's about I want to say 60% of our individual market. But the other 40% of the individual market is an average age of almost 50 years old and 70% female, are people that are in the high-risk pool. If you take out and forget about the older females and with health conditions that are in the state's high-risk pool, our average cost wouldn't be a 3-to-1 ratio between group and individual. It'd be more like 2-to-1. So you're really serving different populations among the markets that helps contribute somewhat, in addition to the employee share, to the cost reduction. To get to your question more specifically, Mr. Chair, we have always had an issue with trying to develop some trust and relationship with the employer market because we're a state-funded program, knowing that we may not be here next year, we're going to be here this year, but who knows. But the other thing, and I think even more important than that, we've been facing is the economy over the last 4 years. We've seen employers drop dependent coverage, not add dependent coverage. So we've been kind of going against the grain of things, irrespective of their view of whether the program's going to be continued or not be continued. We think we've been able to do that to some degree, just not to the degree that we wanted to do it. Another point that I think that's really important is when usually we do business with an employer, has employee 10 employees. Not everybody's eligible from an income standpoint. Generally, what you'll see is one or two or three employees out of the 10 that have the income based on family, not just wage, that would qualify for this program. What an employer runs into is not whether they drop group coverage or not. It's that when you sign up for an employer-based plan, you can't just decide from 1 month to the next, oh, I can't afford it this month, I'm dropping out. You can only drop in and out basically during what's called open enrollment. So an employer is faced with not so much dropping his group coverage as much as it is, how do I figure out how to keep three people afloat if FEOC pulls back their subsidy? I think that's a key thing. But we hear this all the time, Ms. Chair, and it's, you know, again, it's one of the challenges we have. We think we've developed good relationships. We have the support of AOI and NFIB to try to build up the group market, and they continue to put articles in their newsletters to assist us in doing that.
Okay, Ivan, was there a follow-up on that question?
Just one. Thank you. Do these individual plans, do they follow them from job to job?
Ms. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, you mean if somebody gets in a group plan and we're subsidizing them?
Yeah.
And if they move, for example, let's say they lose that job or leave that job for whatever reason, and let's say they go to a job with no group coverage, we will subsidize them in the portability, COBRA, or individual market. Once you're eligible, we'll carry you through those markets. If they go to another group plan, as long as it meets the benchmark, which is required by the federal government, we will subsidize that other group coverage. It will be a different subsidy because the employer's premium share may be different. But, yes, the subsidy follows the individual, not their job.
Okay, I have a question. I think I'll direct it to Mr. Britton.
Okay.
We have $26 million, roughly, that needs to be spent for maintenance of effort if we're going to maintain what we've agreed to based on the waiver.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of spending that, it's going to generate $54 million of match. So now we've got $81 million to spend. If we decided that we did not want to have $81 million because it's going to expand this program beyond its ability to be sustained, would there be any effect on that $26 million, or does that $26 million have to be spent even if we took no match?
Mr. Chair and members, we're on the hook right now, and it, again, it isn't the whole 26 million, but close, yeah. To meet our maintenance of effort agreement right now with the federal government. In the future, if, for example, the legislature and the executive branch said, well, as part of the Oregon Health Plan 3 waiver, whatever that means, we don't want to continue this. We just want to fund it at whatever we want to fund it. We would no longer get match for the FEOP program, and we could fund it at whatever level we felt appropriate.
Okay. What's about the possibility of not spending all $81 million, but getting all the $81 million, and then saying to employers, we're going to cap the spending at a lesser amount, but we can assure you, because we're doing that, that this is going to be in place for at least 4 years or something like that, because now we've got the money, but we don't have to spend the $81 million within the next biennium, do we?
Mr. Chair, you do have to spend it within the next biennium. The federal government, once we pay out and provide the premium subsidy, the federal government actually reimburses us for our expenditures. They don't front us the federal dollars. In fact, we front them the general fund. We make the payment. We get reimbursement back from them through, in this case, the Department of Human Services.
So we could spend as much as $81 million, and if we did, we could get back as much as 50-some million.
Correct.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, related question. If there's not the demand, if we can't enroll enough people to spend the $81 million, what happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that the people are out there, but if we don't expend the dollars, then we put the maintenance of effort and the state in potential of having to pay back federal funds. Our sense is that the demand is out there. Just some history to that. We remained basically closed until it was somewhere around July or August before a decision was made to expand the program and to expend the money. And we held it closed, a political decision, not a fiscal decision, because of Measure 30 and the impact it was having, and not knowing quite yet where we were going to be with the governor's budget. So it wasn't until this last really 6 or 7 months that we got the direction to go ahead and open up the spigot and get the people on. And we basically are trying to enroll the 14 or 15,000 people in a period of 10 months rather than a period of 24 months. And that's why you see us spiking up like this rather than going like that.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, we have a House matter that's going to require us to adjourn today. What I would propose is that we can carry this over till tomorrow. If you could join us for tomorrow.
Sure.
All right. And we'll have public testimony also tomorrow for those that might want to testify. And if there's no objection, we would go ahead and adjourn for today.
John, we can leave.